Welcome to the American Cinematographer Podcast. Go behind the scenes with today's top filmmakers as they discuss the techniques they bring to the art of motion imaging.
This podcast is sponsored by the ASC Masterclass, a five-day seminar taught in Hollywood. Learn more at theasc.com.
Welcome to the American Cinematographer Podcast. I'm Michael Goldman, and we're chatting today with cinematographer Greg Fraser, ASC ACS, who's speaking with us from the country of Jordan, where he's busy filming Denis Villeneuve's 2020 film Dune. But he's joining us today to take a look back at his recent work on the biblical epic Mary Magdalene for his friend, director Garth Davis. Greg, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for making the time.
And I thought to start, it would be a good idea to give us just a little bit of the background on the collaboration with Garth Davis that led you to Mary Magdalene. You know, most of us know you were nominated for an Oscar in 2017 for working with Garth on Lion, and I think that earned you an ASC award and a Camera Image Golden Frog Award. So it's hard to keep track of the order of things, what you did first, second, and third, because you then went on to shoot Rogue One, the Star Wars film. So yes. I don't know when you went into planning for Mary, but maybe you could explain how and why Garth lured you into this project, about a movie about as different from Lion, certainly, or Star Wars, as one could possibly imagine. What attracted you to the material, why you wanted to do it?
Well, I mean, I think that was a huge draw, everything you've just said then, like the fact that it was so different to Lion and Mary Magdalene. Sorry, Lion and Star Wars, you know, and also, you know, Garth is a great friend. So, you know, any opportunity we have to collaborate together, you know, it's always a fantastic time. We've got a very fertile environment, very fertile creative environment that we have whilst we're working together. You know, we very much enjoy it. So, you know, the fact that I could have done Mary, I was prepping Mary as we were doing sort of the reshoots for Rogue One. So again, I mean, going from one world to a vastly different world was actually what was really exciting about the project.
And of course, it's a biblical story from the point of view of Mary Magdalene, who's played by Rooney Mara, one of Jesus' closest followers, a figure of great controversy in biblical history. And it takes the approach of showing Mary as an independent thinker, deeply spiritual, really loyal, something of a character study of her. At the same time, it's ornate, it's a detailed period piece. It really shows the lives, the environment, the clothing, the architecture of ancient Judea, and I guess about the biblical time period of 33 AD. So when you and Garth got together, you know, what was the mission statement he gave you about how he wanted to visualize the period and the people? You know, what was the aesthetic that he was going for on this?
Well, you know, we had a lot of deep meetings about, you know, how society existed at that point in time. There were not that many different sort of professions at that point in time, and societies were spread out, and people, it was almost like the world we had to create. I mean, obviously, there was a lot of text regarding that particular point in time, and I mean, clearly the text that we were drawing from. But actually getting into the minutiae of how people lived, how they slept, how they ate, you know, we kind of had a, you know, had very long conversations about that, because it's quite great. You know, like the only reference we've all got is other films. You know, I mean, the reality is no one exactly knows how people survived and lived in those days. So we had to use all the information that we could to sort of create that. And it was a very exciting process, because we got to basically just discuss how, yeah, even down to the fact, how were people crucified? You know, I mean, we know what the final image of a crucifixion is, but how do people get up onto the cross? How do you get a person onto the cross simply, especially if you're doing it en masse? It was a very, very interesting bigger picture discussion that we had before we even started talking about the visuals.
Yeah, and when I saw it, speaking of some of those issues about how people existed and got along in that time period. You know, how did they sleep? There's a scene where the entire extended family and maybe some close associates are all sleeping in a communal environment on the floor, you know, when Mary gets woken up during one sequence, you know, things like that, how they caught their fish, how they hung their laundry, etc. And you know, of course, it seemed kind of sparse in keeping, you know, the time period in the desert region, but also sweeping wide shots, interesting skies. Obviously, there's no movie cameras back in those days. So what was the philosophy about how to move the camera, how to shoot, you know, how to lens them, and, you know, how not to overdo it? You know, when you're coming off Star Wars, where I'm sure you can go crazy because no one's ever lived in that period. You know, what was the goal here?
Well, the goal here was restraint. You know, I like to think that as much as I can with all of my work, I would like to try and embrace restraint. You know, you often don't need to, I feel, when you're making a movie, you don't need to overdo lighting, camera work, you know, and particularly on a film like this that is so sparse. We particularly did not want to go too heavy-handed with the imagery on this, because there has been a lot of movies made, and we just didn't want to copy those other films. But at the same time, we also didn't want to be overzealous with our depiction of that era. It needed to be simple and straightforward.
And for camera movement, you know, does that mean, was the camera moving a lot? Was it locked down a lot? A little of both?
We moved a little bit when they moved. You know, we had a steady cam on the show, and we occasionally moved the camera when they walked. We occasionally did some walk and talks. But, you know, it's a good question to raise, because a big part of the movie is going from the fishing village of Magdalena to Jerusalem. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion on the road. So we tried really hard to not always having walk and talks. You know, it's a bit of a foible of films. Like, how do you communicate whilst you're moving, like walk and talks? And that can become a little bit tired after a certain period of time. So we tried hard not to do too many walks and talks. That was one of the things we tried. But we had a steady cam, we could do that, and the occasional walk and talk was fine. But then we also explored extremely long lenses. You know, we had a fantastic Canon 75 to 1500 lens, which we used often to film dialogue scenes, you know, in one shot, looking straight at the characters.
So this, you chose to shoot with the Arri Alexa 65 large format system. Was the goal that this should be a large screen format, an anamorphic type approach?
Well, you know, we tested a few lenses. Garth's never been a big fan of anamorphic. You know, it's a general format, which I respect, because he has an aesthetic aversion to the way anamorphic lenses work. He doesn't feel like they're very embracing of the character. So, you know, I showed him the lenses we used on Rogue One, which were a favorite of mine, and he didn't really respond to those. But what he did respond to, which I thought was really fantastic, were the DNAs, the Arri DNAs that I'd helped build with Arri Rental. And, you know, I'd spent a bit of time with them building these lenses to try and get them not too sharp, but still biting and still with depth. And he responded really well to these lenses, which was great in two ways. First of all, it was great because, you know, I helped heavily with Arri with those lenses. And it was also a testament to the fact that all the choices that I had made with Arri, you know, somebody else responded to when I showed them the lenses. So it was a really early days of the Arri DNA glass. So it was nice to see that Garth responded to them as well as I did.
The development of the Arri DNA glass, was that done well in advance of you even knowing that you were going to shoot a Mary Magdalene? Or did you have this film in mind at the time?
No, I didn't, to be honest. When I was working with Arri on the DNAs, you know, that came about because, you know, they'd built their the lenses that came out with the Alexa 65, which were Hasselblad based, you know, they were fine lenses. But I wasn't 100% enamored with the way they performed in some areas. So, you know, I expressed that to Arri, and they were like, great, let's build some lenses. And I'm like, all right, you show me a lens and I'll tell you what I think. Like, you know, I have no idea how to physically build a lens, but I know exactly what I think when it comes to a visual image. So Ari would bring me lenses and I'd put them on and I'd film a face and I'd say, too sharp, not sharp enough, needs to be faster, too clean at the edges, should fall off a bit more, you know, and they'd take their notes and they'd come back and show it again and I'd give other comment. I know they're doing that with other DPs also, but, you know, I was kind of I'm always very happy with our sort of suppliers, be it Arri or Panavision or lighting companies, to give my unabashed, uncensored opinion about the product, you know, because I think it can only make the products better. And, you know, I do have very strong opinions when it comes to lights, lenses, cameras, you know, the whole thing. So it was a fun process with the DNAs. And what was really great was that then Mary Magdalene came up and these lenses, they existed. They didn't fully exist. I think I had to supplement them with a few other lenses. And I was able to sort of easily and quickly draw a set of lenses from Arri Rental.
And then, you know, of course, as we mentioned, you chose the Alexa 65, the large format version. It wasn't, as I understood, the first time you'd use that system. You used it, I believe, a little bit on Lion, and then you used it for Rogue One. You know, why did it make sense to shoot this movie with that system, not go to film? I think you'd shot Vice on film. You know, this is a period piece. Obviously, there, you know, there's no digital back in that era. You know, why was this the correct approach for this material?
Well, yeah, it's funny because you sometimes use film to create nostalgia, don't you? Sometimes when you have film, it kind of creates nostalgia and you know, fills the cracks of the of any problems that you have in production, prosthetics or, you know, on Mary Magdalene, it was a very simple, basic structure. You know, there were no prosthetics. We had very, very interesting looking actors, you know, with between Rooney and Mara and Chiwetel and Torfek and Michael. Like, we had so many fantastic, beautiful looking actors on this movie. And we had such incredible locations in Italy. We shot it in Sicily and in Italy. And we had amazing costumes, you know, like we had some amazing costumes. So to me, it was a no-brainer. I had to use the depth of 65, the Alexa 65, to show all these things off. You know, we had such great things to put in front of the camera and we needed the right camera to film it. And to me, the Alexa 65 was a no-brainer. You know, it was like it was the only format that I could see using for it, frankly, because I didn't think the 35 was good enough to film this level of quality.
And did you learn a lot about using the 65 on Rogue One and a little bit on Lion that was helpful to you on this movie in terms of strengths, weaknesses, approach, etc.?
One thing that the Alexa 65 is really good at is texture. You know, if you've got great texture and you've got a great image, your lenses need to be not too sharp, but they need to resolve enough so you can see what's going on, of course, but they need to not be too sharp, which that's a bit of a problem for the Alexa 65 if you put sharp lenses on it, because then it starts becoming a little bit, I mean, hard to watch, frankly. But if you find the right combination of softness with the lenses, the right subject material in front of the camera, you know, I tend to think, and again, horses for courses, and everyone has a different opinion about this, and I that's what I love about our industry. But I think if you had a set that had really flat lines on it, like reflective surfaces or like chrome or modern buildings, I don't know if the Alexa 65 is the best thing for it, because it really shows off the plasticky nature of some of those things, you know. Whereas if you've got great texture, it's really good. I mean, the perfect example in Rogue One, you know, we had there's the rebel stuff, and then there's the Imperial stuff. The Imperial stuff has grey walls and simple grey walls. I didn't think the Alexa 65 was as good on those sets as it was on really deteriorated textural subjects.
And speaking of the subjects and you know, sort of the you know, the gritty realism and this kind of thing, you were talking about your cast, and I noticed that Joaquin Phoenix playing Jesus Christ, which is, you know, a fairly lofty role for anyone to take on. You guys opted for and captured in your lens, you know, a very gritty, realistic Jesus. He's not this beautiful boy with perfectly coiffed hair and beard. He's rough. He looks like someone who's been wandering through the desert, going from town to town, getting whipped by wind and sunburned, you know, and maybe assaulted a few times and things like that. The beard while. Yeah, how important was it to how you were going to frame him and capture him to give us maybe a different look at Jesus from the I guess somewhat understandable desire that many people would have to show him as near perfect, you know, so to speak.
This is what I was saying. It sort of went back to us really fleshing out the story. We took away the, you know, what history has said about the man and what people think about the man, and went, well, yeah, if you're walking from this lake to this city, and over the course of, you know, we've all been to the Middle East. Like, I'm sitting in Jordan. If I walked from here, you know, 300 miles, I'm going to look pretty scragged, you know. Like, I don't think there were many washing machines back then. I don't know about that again, but I don't think there was an opportunity for laundromats, you know. So therefore, you start to go, well, how do the costumes look? They're dirty. They're pretty mucky. How do people use the restroom? Like, what's the underlying truth behind people living in that era? Now, I'm not talking about the spirituality side of things, because that's something which people can take away from the film in different ways. I'm talking more about the reality of humans living in this part of the world in that era. How would it be? And yes, absolutely, you'd have windburn. I mean, you should see me now. Like, I've been standing in the desert for 4 weeks filming. I'm terribly windburned. You know, my hair needs a condition. It's like I've literally just walked out of the desert. You know, so we kind of went down that track with him to make sure. And that was fantastic, because it allowed, again, going back to the format, to really excel. The Alexa 65, I mean, Joaquin's face is textured and beautiful and gnarly, and his hair was gnarly. And then you throw that up against the opposite of Rooney Mara, who's got this porcelain complexion and, you know, beautiful hair. And I mean, you know, it was a really lovely thing to watch the dailies on that, because we had great contrast between the lead actors.
And speaking of dailies, you know, I think you shot the movie in Italy. You know, what was the workflow approach, the capture format, producing your dailies? How accessible were, you know, technicians and labs and everything? Or did you rough it quite a bit?
No, we didn't actually. It was quite fantastic. We had Pinewood Post, Tom and James there at Pinewood Post. You know, those guys, particularly Tom and James, were instrumental in getting us set up in Italy and to be able to process that level of data. You know, we had those guys and Muna and my dailies colorist, Chris Rudkin, who had done Lion. He did the dailies on Lion. And, you know, we started my frustration sometimes with dailies is that, you know, you spend all these hours every day. You finish shooting, you go in there for 2 hours and you grade. And more often than not, as it used to be, that grade would get thrown away. You'd start again in 8 months' time when you grade the movie. And I was like, I couldn't for the life of me work out why in this day and age we were doing that. So with Pinewood Post and with Chris and with our post facility, sound firm in Melbourne, we worked out a system where we were doing dailies, viewing dailies in P3, and it was then converting to Rec 709 to the editorial. But we were watching dailies in Italy on a theatrical monitor. And then when we went to grade in 8 months or whatever it was identical to what we'd worked on in Italy. So that took a lot of wrangling, and the guys there did an incredible job of wrangling that, because it was the best dailies experience I've had.
And are you able to, or do you hope to replicate that on other shows? I don't know what you're doing on Dune.
It's we're doing we're having a great experience on Dune as well. It's different. I've got Chris Rodkin here doing dailies for this as well, but here he's working with the Photochem Next Lab system, which we worked with on Vice. And again, I'm having a great experience with that as well. It's a slightly different system, but again, it's we're getting great results. So, yeah, you know, the idea that I have the dailies lab with us close by is really important, because it means I can view stuff the same day that we shoot it.
The other thing I was curious about watching this film was the lighting philosophy and execution with your gaffer, Jamie Mills, I believe. Obviously, it's an ancient time. It's a period piece. A lot of the movie takes place outdoors at night, twilight, even when they're inside a hut. They're the ancient style. All they have is sun or moonlight or a firelight.
Wow. Yeah.
What were the big picture lighting challenges you had, and what were some of the solutions you came up with?
Well, listen, at its core, this was not a big movie. You know, it wasn't a big film that we could bring a really big lighting truck, because we were in very remote locations. I mean, we had to go quite remote to get rid of civilization. It's remarkably hard to find big areas of land that don't have civilization near them. It's particularly in Europe. So, you know, we knew we had to be in Europe, but we eventually found locations that were quite remote, which is a great thing for visuals, but it's a bad thing for the infrastructure. You know, you can't get generators there, and it's hard to get lighting trucks. So, you know, I decided, you know, and this is on the back of Rogue One, actually, having such great success with the LEDs on Rogue One. And I decided to pretty much light the entire movie with LEDs and with portable generators. So we had a few portable generators that, you know, were a little bit noisy, but we were able to park them over the hill and cover them for the sound guys. But we had no big generators. We had small generators, and we had, I think, 20 digital Sputnik DS6s that did all of the work. They did the fire on the tables, we had DS1s for fire, anything that coming through windows, we added DS6s. So we ended up having 20 heads, DS6s, to do that entire show. So I was really happy with that, because it was efficient. We dialed in the color. Chris Rudkin, who is, again, our dailies colorist, he came in and actually dialed the color in for our daylight look and our fire look. So in prep, rather than the dimmer board operator dialing in the color, I had my colorist do it, which he dialed the color in and changed the values to get the right color. So we were actually grading the light before we went out into the field. And then that became our standard day look. You know, normally you have a LUT on a camera. We had a day look, which was a certain color value for our day. And then we had a dusk look, and then we had a night look, and we had a fire look.
And, you know, speaking of, you know, being in a remote location, you're working in Italy in a remote area. Right now you're in Jordan. It's a bigger movie, but you're still in remote areas. And you have, I guess, quite a bit of experience with your background, you know, working with in foreign locations, foreign crews, where you're not in the middle of Hollywood, where literally every instrument ever invented would be available to you.
Yeah.
You know, working with foreign crews and foreign infrastructure and foreign power and all that, in what ways is the collaboration and the approach different than when you're on one of those big tentpole American films, when you're on a Star Wars or a superhero movie or something like that?
Well, you know, obviously, again, every DP you speak to, Michael, will have a different opinion on this, because some people say, yep, it was a small movie, therefore we only have a small amount of lights. I mean, here we are in Jordan on a big film. You know, I've got a smaller package here than I had on Mary Magdalene. You know, I think I've got 6 DS6s or maybe 10 DS6s and some HMIs. But back in Budapest, it's a different story, because we're lighting big sets. So it's really about, like, if you've got sets, then you need lights. But I'm still of the approach that if you can go small and you're efficient, it's faster. It's faster, it's better, it's cheaper, it looks better. You know, I mean, we've been lighting with these LA Digital Sputniks for the last 4 weeks, and it looks incredible. You can't tell it's been lit. You can't tell where the light's coming from. It's fantastic. So, I don't know, I'm a huge convert, as you probably can hear. But my approach doesn't change. Unless we have to create nighttime in the desert, or we have to create a consistent sun from a one direction, well, then, yes, you're going to need some light. But I try really hard not to put myself in those positions.
And there's, of course, in this movie, Mary Magdalene, a couple scenes that are quite iconic and very moving. And one of them is when Mary is awoken from her slumber by her brothers and her father, and they drag her out to the ocean for an exorcism. They believe her refusal to accept and arrange marriage, as was the custom at the time, is a sign that she's consumed by a demon. How did you get in the water, film that, light that, the logistics of that? I know there was also a bigger scene where Jesus is baptizing people, as well, yeah. Working in the water. You know, how were those handled?
Well, yeah, I mean, again, on a lower budget, it is hard because, you know, we couldn't afford to light an entire lake, so we had to carefully time it that we did the wides, you know, dusk for night, and then the close-ups we had to light. So it was a very fine balance between lighting dusk for night and then lighting, and then to get the camera in the water, we tried very, very hard not to, because again, we didn't have the resources to get an underwater unit and the whole thing. So we had to be very, very smart about putting platforms in the water and holding the camera close, you know, with safeties and splash bags and the whole thing.
And then, of course, you know, the most iconic stuff, stuff we've read and seen before, the march of Jesus bearing his cross, suffering, leading up to his crucifixion. You mentioned, you know, what are the details of a crucifixion? It's described one way in the Bible and in various literature. Great filmmakers have shown it their view, you know, Scorsese and Mel Gibson and these kinds of guys. What was the philosophy here for lensing those, making it seem realistic and sort of in keeping with the tone of the rest of the movie, that these are human beings, these aren't gods from Mount Olympus or something like that, and yet have it be historically make sense and do what you need to do logistically and all that?
Well, you know, knowing the Bible story quite closely, it was very, very, I mean, there is a certain level of awe that one has seeing a person on a cross like that. You know, most of us have grown up with that image, you know, at the forefront of our society. You know, it sits quite prominently at the forefront of a lot of our societies, you know. So, you know, I wanted to make sure that whilst you didn't really need to create shots that made it iconic, because it just was iconic. You know, it'd be, you know, anybody in the world can almost pick what that shape is. You know, one of the first ways we wanted to reveal him on the cross was a shadow. And I can't recall the edit right now, but, you know, as Mary's running up, we revealed it all from Mary's point of view, her perspective. And as she's running up to see him on the cross, because she gets knocked out during his approach to the crucifixion, you know, we see it in shadow. We see the cross in shadow, and then she enters as a shadow. We didn't want necessarily the first image that our audience sees of the cross as that shocking, harsh, bloodied Jesus. We wanted to kind of to soften the audience into that image. You know, we wanted to make sure that also Jesus did seem beautiful, but not necessarily beautiful in a godly way, but beautiful in a humanistic way. You know, and you know, I needed to make sure that we saw right into his eyes, and we saw him staring back at her. You know, like we managed to angle the cross. You know, we had a cross that was able to be rotated slightly to the light, which was an important thing, to be able to hold the weight of a man and be rotated a little bit. That's a hard thing to do. So, you know, I could get light just into his eyes, just skimming the side of his eyes. You know, there's a beautiful shot. There's one of the shots I'm probably the most proud of in the movie, where it's looking straight into his eyes from her perspective as he's hanging on the cross, and I think he's nearing the end, and the light's just glistening past the side of his head, and it's just lighting through his eyeball. It's a very, very, it's when I was filming it, I turned the crucifix just enough and it hit it at the right time, and I was like, we've got to shoot, this is amazing. And it is, it's a beautiful study of a man's eyes and his pain.
And speaking of what's iconic or what's not iconic, you guys also include a little scene that we don't usually see in a lot of these movies, which is Jesus's followers and family and friends burying him after he's come down off the cross, after he's died. What was the approach to that? Because you can see there's wounds on him and it's deeply moving, but you didn't go close up to show us a bunch of gore either. It seemed like the purpose of the scene was to show the pain of those around him who've now lost him or think they've lost him. How was that scene shot?
I mean, again, I think that was, we got, I think, a little bit lucky with that day. There was a bit of fog on that day in the area, in Matera. And it was supposed to be late afternoon, you know, like or dusk. So we got quite lucky with the mood being quite solemn. You know, we just made sure we followed Mary and we followed the people around Jesus, just trying to tell their stories as best we could. You know, again, we moved the camera when we needed to, but we didn't when we did it. Like it was quite a, again, we tried to be quite restrained with any sort of movement. You know, I tend to feel that unmotivated movement is a distraction, and you know, so I tried very hard not to move the camera if I didn't need to. There were times though that when you move the camera you give strength to a performance or a character, and so in those instances we then move the camera. But it was a good little sequence to shoot. The whole crucifixion and aftermath was good.
And then by contrast, I guess what would be the closest thing in this movie to an action scene, the moneylender sequence in the temple, the chaos, the confusion, the rage of Jesus, and then Mary, running out and them trying to get out of this massive and dangerous place. What was the approach for that sequence?
Well, we had sort of multiple viewpoints in that sequence, didn't we? Like we had all the disciples going to do their own thing, and then we had Mary. You know, obviously Mary is the center of the movie, clearly based on the title. But we needed to make sure that this the mood and the tone of the rabble was increasing. You know, with the songs and the chants, and it was almost like things were going on over there, things were going here. You know, Mary had lost Jesus, so Mary sees Jesus through the crowd, sees him staring, sees him, can't get to him because he's so far away. And, you know, us as an audience gets inside his head, seeing him seething and raging before he starts turning over and destroying things. So what was great about that was we had, again, a limited time and limited budget, like with all movies, but we had to just maximize the fact that it felt like it was massive, where it was hordes of people. So I think we had, 100 people or something like that, and we very carefully, every time we shot a scene, we very carefully taped off what the camera saw left and right. We ran a string, for the angle from the camera outwards each side, and we came right to the edge of frame and brought as many people right there as possible. So it would have been quite funny watching this film because we'd have had these kind of pizza wedges of people that we were filming into. Because we wanted to create that idea that she's so far away from him and that she's so far away from the other disciples that she can't get them to help him. So it was very much about creating distance with those characters. And we used, longer lenses for that, which helped significantly.
And, the whole notion of everybody being, there being a large location, there being so much confusion and, what's going on in one location isn't necessarily what the people in some other part of the scene are even experiencing. I thought that was quite effective. What was the location, or did you build a set over there?
No, we found a plaza. We found a plaza that doubled for the temple. And, it was a public plaza that I think we had for 2 days. And we could own, I believe, half of it for the morning and then a quarter of it for the afternoon. So, I think we did some trickery to flop some angles to make it feel like we were looking back into the other side. It was quite a carefully planned sequence because we really just we didn't have the resources to create a massive temple scene. You know, we there were some visual effects, obviously, to create the temple structure beyond the physical structure that we had, but we didn't have the resources to be able to fill the entire. I mean, it would have taken, you know, 5,000 people to fill that, and you know, we didn't have those resources. I mean, most films don't have those resources, frankly. So we just had to be clever with our angles and our shot structure to try and make it feel like we were shooting into every direction of the temple.
Now, when you got the movie shot and you moved into the post phase, what was the strategy or the approach for the digital intermediate? You mentioned that, you know, you didn't want to have to do your color correction twice, months apart, and all that. What facility and colorist did you go to, and was the idea to, you know, sew some things together and tweak around the edges, or was it really a full extension of your cinematography to do the DI?
Well, no, the final daily, the final colorist was Chris Rudkin, who did our dailies. And that's what was, to me, that's what was the most exciting part about doing Mary Magdalene, is that we had the same colorist doing our dailies as doing our final. So he was effectively in charge of the color. Like, he went into editorial, he made sure that the editorial department had the same color as what he was seeing. Right now, in the system that we all have, and, you know, listen, some people may disagree with me here, and that's fine. I'll happily have a debate. But there is not one person whose job it is, like one person who's a visual person, to go through and make sure that all the monitors that everybody's looking at is the same. You know, it just doesn't exist. I know there are boffins, and I know there are color pipeline people and all those other things from post companies, but there is not one person in charge of going into editorial and saying, hey, your the sound editor, the monitor is not calibrated. Let's calibrate it, or let's get this monitor so that when the director sees it every single time, he's looking at the same color every single time. You know, because now it's critical, because if you put the wrong grade on during dailies, editor, the studio, the director, they all get used to looking at that color. So then if you want to change the color in 8 months, people are resistant to the change because they've seen it a certain way. So that's why on that show, which was so good, I had the dailies colorist do our final grade.
And was there a specific edict about, you know, the color aesthetic, the palette, the philosophy? It's ancient times. You can't have, you know, neon reds or, you know, or was that sort of just a given and you went with what you shot?
Well, exactly. We pretty much, I mean, listen, the obviously we could have hyper realized the color. We could have upped it and we could have made skin tones crazy, and we could have, you know, we could have done what a lot of contemporary current movies do, which is add a look to it. And I say that with, you know, inverted commas, a look. You know, we could have added a sepia tone to the whole film. We could have made it look like a certain color. We deliberately did not want to make it have a look. I mean, it does. Intrinsically, it does. It's kind of ridiculous to say because everything has a look. It's just that you choose to try and make it, again, play in the background. You know, desaturated colors, but not so desaturated that you lose skin tone. You know, it's important to maintain skin tone. It's important to maintain the beautiful colors that the costume designer came up with and the production designer. Like, you don't want to cut those out, you know? So we wanted to maintain those colors, yet not be too garish with them.
Given how busy you are, you know, I really appreciate that you carved out the time to talk to us about Mary Magdalene, which I think is a quite an interesting film, and I hope people get an opportunity to see it.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I'm very proud of that film. I think it's beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful films I shot, I think. You know, and I think that I'm the work that Garth did on it's great too. So, yeah, very 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 excited for people to see it.
Well, again, I really appreciate it, and thanks, Greg, for joining us today on the American Cinematographer Podcast. Really appreciate it.
Nice. Thanks, Michael.
This has been the American Cinematographer Podcast. Thanks for listening. You can find more podcasts, blogs, and exclusive ASC content by logging onto theasc.com. This podcast has been brought to you by the American Society of Cinematographers, a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting the art and craft of cinematography.